Hey, folks, I'm Denise Howell, and you're about to listen to This Week in Law with me, Mike Keyes, and Emery Roan. We're going to discuss hacking the news, quiet cars, parrots in peril, and boldly going where no Lorax has gone before. All those and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 367, recorded November 18th, 2016. All about the cyber. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/TWiL. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWiL. Hey, everybody, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Welcome back after the election. We were off on Veterans Day last week, but now would be a good time to remind you that this is the place where we converge on Friday afternoons at, in the morning is when we start on the West Coast, 11 o'clock Pacific time, to do this show where we get together to talk about the law and the cyber. And that's what we're here for today. My two wonderful co-hosts are here with us, not in the studio. None of us are in the studio, but we're here doing This Week in Law for you right now. Mike Keyes is back with us after a couple of shows off. Great to see you again, Mike.
Denise and Emery, great to be back with you as always, and looking forward to talking about cyber and many other things today.
Absolutely. Mike is a partner at Dorsey and Whitney in Seattle. We are guestless in Seattle today. I guess we can say that because of your location, Mike. It's just our three hosts on the show today, and we've got a lot of exciting stuff to talk about, so I have no problem with that whatsoever. Also here with us is Emery Roan, who is a third-year law student at California Western School of Law in San Diego and an up-and-coming warrior on fronts of the cyber. So it's wonderful to see you again, Emery.
Well, that's the goal anyways. Thanks, Denise. It's always a pleasure to be here. And I'm excited to have the whole crew back on staff. I think I'm excited to pick some trademark questions against at Mike. So let's dig into it.
Yes, let's dig into it as well. So there is much to discuss. Things have shifted around politically in our country since the last time we did the show. Much is feeling to me a bit like the 1980s, which I lived through with good, strong memories of it. Every upper degree school that I graduated from took place in the 1980s or just at the very end of them is when I graduated law school. So in their honor, since it's feeling like we've sort of rolled back a bit to that time, that's when Donald Trump built Trump Tower, after all. I remember visiting Trump Tower on my very first trip ever to New York, which I believe must have been about 1986, and it was still a pretty new building at the time. So in that honor, I have dug out of my closet this thing looks the most like the 1980s of anything I own anymore. It lacks shoulder pads, but has puffy sleeves and is made of something like taffeta. So I trotted that out for you here today. Emery, you don't remember the 80s as well as we do. So if you need, and I'm assuming that Mike remembers them, you know, partially as well as I do. So if you need a primer.
I remember them very well.
There we go. We had some good things in the 80s. It wasn't all bad. The 80s gave us Skeletor. So there's that, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. It also gave us the movie Wall Street. If you haven't watched that in a while, that might be a good one to go back and watch. And Working Girl, of course, in the late 80s with Melanie Griffith. And I tried to do the huge Melanie Griffith hair for you all today, but I think I've forgotten how to do that. And I've also forgotten how to tell people that I have a head for business and a bod for sin. So with all of that framework in mind, let us jump into our discussion today. And we're going to start with an issue that has been much on people's minds since the election: fake news. All right, so why are we talking about journalism on a law site or on a law show? I'll tell you why. Because journalism and the law have a very interconnected relationship with the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and with the defamation laws in our country. So what you no doubt have heard about that we want to get into a little more deeply on the show today are steps by Facebook and Google primarily, but perhaps others, to deal with the problem that there are many websites out there in the world that are generating quote unquote news articles that are really just social engineering, for lack of a better word. They are headlines and substance that aren't true, that are so sensational and outrageous that, as far as I can tell, they are designed to play on people's biases and predispositions to get them to click on something that maybe they want to believe is true, or that it wouldn't surprise them if that were true. But in fact, the thing in question was not true at all. And a lot of people in this election cycle have found themselves suckered in, whether they knew it or not, by fake news sites that are operating because, lo and behold, it's lucrative to have people visit your website if you have ads there or otherwise are finding ways to monetize your content. So Facebook and Google have come out and said, well, we're gonna try and do something about this. We're going to ban them from using our ad networks. But Mark Zuckerberg has come out recently and said that the user issue, the issue of people who are taking links and sharing them on the site without vetting the truth of what's found at that link, that he thinks that that did not have an impact on the election. And that's kind of where I want to get into things today. Is what sort of responsibility and or liability could sites have for making sure that their users are sharing truthful things? I think that's problematic on a number of fronts. And also, what sort of recourse is there under the law as it exists right now for these sites that are propagating fake news stories in search of bucks? So, Emery, I'm curious to get your take on all this.
Yeah, so I think this is a really thorny issue, a really interesting issue. You know, I think that the 2016 election, you know, books are going to be written, articles are going to be written about this for years, trying to, explain what exactly happened. But the narrative that this is the disinformation election, I think, is really interesting. You know, we have a couple articles in the show notes today about how chatbots were used at unprecedented levels in this election on both sides, but especially on the Trump side, to influence the narrative on Twitter. The fact that these websites are, you know, there's been a couple of interviews with people that have professed to being some of the authors of these fake news articles, and the sort of economic arguments that these authors are making is really interesting. That, you know, a lot of these people are just saying, you know, this is just recognizing that if it bleeds, it leads, holds true on the internet as well. You know, this is the idea that sensationalist journalism sells well, I don't think is really that surprising. But at the same time, I don't know, bringing into the questions of legal liability, I think, as far as I can see, this is, you know, a pretty classic CDA situation where you would want the provider to be not liable for the speech of its users. Because if you have the alternative, then you know, that opens the door to a lot of censorship. And I think once you and by the way, it gets rid of the safe harbors that, you know, the platform would have. But I mean, I think that another side of this that's not really talked about is the idea that people think that the news that is being pushed to the top of their Facebook feed or their Twitter page are totally a result of these sort of social pressures or, you know, upvoting or thumbs upping or, you know, liking by their friends. But that's ignoring the fact that there is curation being done automatically through algorithms on this content. You know, there are algorithms out there that are designed to encourage the propagation of news that is, you know, relevant to you on these social networks. And, you know, those are black boxes that we don't really know how they work and that aren't necessarily transparent, but they can result in this similar kind of like bubble and filtering. So I don't know. It is I'm still reeling as much as everyone else, I think, from last Tuesday. But what kind of legal liability? I don't really see any good option for putting legal liability on websites to make sure that their users aren't reading fake news or aren't sharing fake news. I would hope that there's some sort of technological answer. It seems like the more immediate solution is just to hire. I mean, again, like this came back to when Facebook fired its curation team. You know, I mean, this was being talked about throughout the election when, you know, Facebook first fired the curation team and editors. You saw huge numbers of fake articles start trending. So maybe just hire more people, hire humans to try to do this job if we can't trust the algorithms to do it fairly.
Right.
Are
the
humans going to do it any more fairly?
Let's play that out a bit, though. Say you're Facebook and you decide that's a step you're going to take. Are you going to go to users then and say and flag posts that they have shared and say, this looks to us like it might be fake news? And then are you going to leave it in their hands or are you going to start taking things down?
I mean, I guess it also comes down to what the website wants to be about. You know, if this is a website, if Facebook is saying that they're not supposed to be a news site, that they're just supposed to be a way of connecting people to their friends and families, I don't think that they necessarily need to care about whether the news is truthful once they say that they are. I mean, obviously that contradicts the sort of dueling narratives that Zuckerberg likes to push about Facebook, that it is, you know, hugely influential in like the Arab Spring, but it is not a news company at all. This is just a social media connecting company. I don't know. You know, if you want to be a news company, I think that, yeah, editors are important. And if you are, I don't know, I think that I wish I had more well-formed thoughts on this. Unfortunately, it's just a thorny issue. And I don't see any good solution from placing liability on websites to police the truthfulness of content.
Right. And you mentioned the Communications Decency Act safe harbor that websites like Google and Facebook availed themselves of to escape liability for certain things that would be actionable that their users may do on the site. And it seems to me that they're getting themselves into a thicket if they start. I agree with you that some degree of editorial would be helpful for the problem. But I wonder, you know, when the CDA lawyers come in and say, you know, we can't be editorializing on the site too much or we lose that safe harbor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
that's very important.
That's something they're going to have to navigate. Mike, what do you think about, as Emery points out, I think we're in a situation where it's very hard to go to the source of these fake news stories and do anything about them legally. We have defamation laws, certainly, that are designed to be a check on the credibility and veracity and legitimacy of the news that's reported in our country. But how those laws function is you have to be the subject of the story and decide, they've said something about me that is false and I'm going to sue. And oh, by the way, if I'm a public figure, and this is what Donald Trump is referring to when he talks about opening up the libel laws, if I'm a public figure, I have a harder time meeting the standard of proof in that kind of lawsuit. I have to show that the news site in question, the quote unquote news site in question, acted with actual malice in order to prevail against them. So in a lot of these fake news situations, the defamation laws just aren't that helpful, because sometimes the fake news isn't about a person. We have a good example in our rundown today, and everyone can look at everything that we're discussing today on the show if they go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're in episode 367 today. There's a good example about Mike Huckabee, who got suckered by a fake news story, it appears, and had to come out and apologize for sharing, resharing a fake news story that accused Jewish liberals of being responsible for a swastika incident. In other words, what Huckabee thought he was sharing was a story that said, oh, this wasn't really a hate crime. This was something that was engineered, and, you know, maybe even these people were paid. But for whatever reason, this was a fake outrage and not a real outrage, was the point that he was trying to make by sharing the story. However, that wasn't actually the case. If he had fact-checked it and gone back to the source, he might have learned that, we have no evidence whatsoever that those are the people who perpetrated this incident. So he had to come out and apologize. But here, there's no defamation remedy. The party defamed there is maybe Jewish liberals, and I don't think they have standing to sue, right, Mike?
I would think that's exactly right. You know, this is a very thorny issue, as Emery alluded to at the outset of the show. So just to provide a little bit more context for this, according to the Pew Research Group that recently did a study, approximately 50% of the adult population that uses Facebook gets their news from Facebook. And so this is a tremendous problem with people being misled. In the show's lineup today, Denise, as you pointed out, there's lots of stories that went viral during the political season, you know, hundreds of thousands of likes on fake news stories and other things, including such news as, you know, the Pope endorses Donald Trump and other stories that, you know, don't necessarily have a defamatory component to it in the traditional sense of you're defaming somebody, but you're certainly misleading a tremendous amount of the voting population, if not the public writ large. So it is a tremendous problem. I think this is, you know, the problem is compounded that much further by how do you go after the wrongdoers? Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult to say, well, we're going to go after Facebook. I mean, under Section 230, they'd probably be immune from liability anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the right result. I mean, we want these very robust online forums, and we want to make sure that they are protected and that they thrive. I think ultimately this is going to be an issue where Facebook's going to get involved and really, you know, take the bull by the horns here and disincentivize people for doing and propagating this sort of fake news. There was a story that was in the lineup today about, I think, a series of individuals or a bunch of folks in Greece that were responsible for spreading a lot of fake news and ultimately profiting from it. So I think they're going to have to remove that incentive, that monetary incentive for people to profit from fake news. How do you do that? I mean, I think it's probably difficult. Maybe what you do is you quarantine funds for a certain amount of time. Maybe you make your terms of service more robust, and you submit somebody, you know, require that they've automatically submitted themselves to the, you know, a certain tribunal, and that their PayPal funds are going to be up for grabs if ultimately they're adjudicated to have spread fake news. I mean, it's got to be something like that, I would think, in order to really nip this in the bud, because it's a tremendous problem, the cyber problem. As a president-elect
today. Yep. Cyber is a problem. The cyber is a problem. Google at least has another layer that comes into play here, in that in order to be featured in their news search results, there is some vetting that goes into that. Now, I'm not saying that you couldn't find fake news in Google's news search results. I'm sure that that happens from time to time, but they're at least trying. They do some vetting there. And I know there are two sides to that. On the one hand, it's great to keep fake news away from people who are searching the news on Google. On the other hand, as someone who started internet life as a blogger, there is certainly frustration and exclusion that happens for people who are out there doing worthwhile information sharing and analysis, but somehow haven't made the cut to arrive in the hallowed halls of Google News. So there's definitely a tension there, and I'm not sure, you know, really how I fall down on, you know, which side of the issue should Google, you know, again, maybe it goes back to Emery's point that you need staffs of people with good analysis skills to figure out these problems. And I just, maybe that's too much to expect.
But then at that point, as I think you had mentioned, Denise, if you've got all these, you know, an army of staff that's going to go through and start reviewing these stories, to what extent do you then lose your Section 230 immunity if you are actually, you know, the publisher? Would you be considered the publisher in that context? So it's that's a very difficult situation to kind of work through from a legal perspective. You want to do the right thing, and no doubt Mark Zuckerberg and all the folks at Facebook want to eradicate fake news from Facebook, I would think. But how you go about doing it? Now, I understand there is a countervailing argument that, well, yes, fake news really drives a lot of visitors and ad revenue as a result, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, I got to think that an organization like Facebook realizes that fake news, even if it might be it might provide a monetary benefit in the short term, is a long-term problem that needs to be dealt with. Because over the long haul, you know, if your network is just littered with fake news and stuff that people can't rely on, you know, it may lose its luster as a medium for people to visit.
I don't know, though. I mean, I don't know. I'm not entirely convinced on that. If we've seen anything from the bubbling of social groups, you know, the social media seems to have, rather than bringing us all together, made us really good at siloing ourselves into little echo chambers. And that feels good on the internet, interacting with people that think exactly like you, by and large. I think a lot of people like that about Facebook and about Twitter. And, you know, I think that a lot of the tension, a lot of the pushback against Twitter is when, I don't want to minimize real abuse and real, you know, attacks on Twitter. But also, I think that a lot of the problems that people have with Twitter are when they have these different bubbles clashing up against each other, and you have trolls on one side being really cruel to people on the other side, on both, you know, going both directions. I mean, there's a couple of articles that we have in the show notes today. One from Snopes. Eric Goldman's takedown of I don't think we're going to get to it today, but essentially there, you know, the argument that there is economic incentives not to necessarily stop the spread of fake news is, I think, a real thing to consider. Snopes, of course, has an article that says that listen, fake news is not the problem, guys, which I found really hilarious considering like two paragraphs up. It's like Snopes has grown 85% in the past year thanks to the spread of fake news on the internet. So I guess it's not surprising that certainly Snopes might not have a problem with the spread of fake news, but I'm not also convinced that Facebook, you know, is clear that they don't want to lose their 230 protections. I think they like the fact that they are a social media network. And, you know, I think they've clearly tried to distance themselves from saying that they're a news network because of that. And so are there real incentives to try to fix this problem? I'm not entirely convinced.
Yeah. So if there aren't, what I keep sort of tossing around in my head is, since defamation isn't really a check on these kinds of things, you're not going to try and go after the Macedonian teenagers who are not just clickbaiting, but really socially engineering people into, you know, they're writing things that they're, it's like a honeypot. They're trying to get people to click on these sites because they're things they think their audience wants to believe.
Right.
So you can't, you know, it's not as a practical matter. You might have the lack of standing problem that I mentioned in the case of the Mike Huckabee issue, but you also just don't have suable defendants as a practical matter. You can't bring those people into court in the U.S. or you can try, but goodness knows it's going to take a lot of resources and time and determination, and God love you if you do it, but it's going to be really hard.
One of the other problems there, Denise, is, mm-hmm. you know, these teenagers that are profiting in Macedonia, you know, the money goes, you know, the U.S. dollar goes much further in Macedonia than it does mm-hmm. in the U.S. So, you know, these kids may not be making a tremendous amount of money by U.S. standards, you know, in Macedonia. I think it can be a pretty tidy sum. So, you know, again, right. you've got that economic incentive that's lower in that part of the globe than it might otherwise be in other parts. So removing right. that economic incentive, be it people in the U.S. or Macedonia or wherever, I think is got to be key.
I feel like we're talking campaign finance reform now.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. And uh-huh. and what I keep coming back to is, do we need, and I haven't answered this question for myself, do we need some sort of news legitimacy standards that are promulgated as laws that we don't have now? And I, of course, that's
scary.
Really problematic because of the First Amendment, of course.
Right.
So, you know, the answer is probably no. It's probably scarier than the problem that it's trying to fix. Or do we just need, and again, this is sort of wishing on a star, that people actually were aware of the fact that probably 85% or more of what they see on the internet is trash and needs to be. I love the internet. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
It's wonderful in so many ways, but you have to look at it. Not through rose-colored glasses, but through a huge bunch of skepticism. And you have to know that there are sites out there that if something looks too good or too outrageous to be true, that will help you understand that they're not true. And I think it's a lot to expect people to view things that way. And I want to show you an example of what I mean in that... where's the story? Oh, it's Business Insider ranked 11 election stories that went viral on Facebook. So they have 11 examples. And I want to show you one of them. Victor, it's the one on the side, abcnews.com/co. Nope, not that. There. That's probably it. Yes, the one. Yes, Obama signing an executive order banning the Pledge of Allegiance in schools nationwide. This thing has an ABC News logo on top. It has an abcnews.com domain. If you didn't look further than .com, there's also a .co after that. And so very hard if someone shares this with you. You're like, oh, my God, ABC News is reporting that they're no longer going to be saying the Pledge of Allegiance it's in schools and that this – has been decreed by executive order, which is already a hot button issue, right? So a friend of mine, actually, just to take a step back on the echo chamber point, it does matter who your friends are and how you curate who you're following, et cetera. And I definitely have the echo chamber problem, but I have a lot of very wide-rangingly viewed friends, which really, I think, helps. And I encourage people to try and design their social feeds that way. And so I was with one of my friends who was a person who looked at this and is a right-leaning person and said, oh, my gosh, look at this, Denise, and showed it to me. We were out with our kids, so she physically showed it to me on her phone. And I read it and I looked at the top of it and went, God, that looks like ABC News. But the first thing I then did was go to Google News because I knew that if this thing had happened, it would be all over. There would be other outlets reporting it. And I saw nothing on the topic in Google News, first red flag, right? And then I went to all the usual suspects of Snopes and PolitiFact and factcheck.org. And I eventually found the thing that I could show her and say, look, not only is this fake, but it's really old fake. And it's now being recycled to influence your views of the election. Or even if it's not, it's probably not being recycled for that purpose. It's being recycled so that the person who's publishing it can make money off the clicks.
You know, you bring up a great point. The fact that a lot of this stuff is recycled and plagiarized, if there ever was... Google and Facebook absolutely have the technology, have the resources to be able to, I think, stop this problem, or at least seriously put a lot of effort towards stopping it. You know, these are the same people that have massive databases on every single person's social connections. And, you know, they know all of our website history. They know they've indexed basically the entire internet. You know, you think that there are certainly ways of algorithmically recognizing duplicates, for example, or websites that are, you know, masquerading as other websites. So the technology is probably there. The question then becomes of, well, we have all these sort of free speech issues that people bring up when private companies try to curate the speech on their services. So, you mean, obviously, there was the news earlier in this election process when Twitter banned some white nationalist / alt-right speakers on Twitter. And, you know, everyone exploded. And, you know, there's the article by Gizmodo this week that Facebook apparently floated the idea for some of these filters for fake news, but they found out that it disproportionately affected one political group over another. And so they opted not to enforce these over political reasons. So, you know, not only is there a legal question of whether or not we legally want to put any liability on these services, but there's also the political problem that a lot of this is perceived as censorship, that a lot of people see, yeah, any of this as censorship, and that makes it frequently politically unpalatable, I think, to implement practices that would curb the problem of fake news, which is why I'm not as optimistic that in the long run, fake news is necessarily bad for business.
Right. I think there's the education problem at least has begun. I mean, this has been all over the real news cycles this week. And I think people are beginning to wake up to the fact that this happens. And they have to be more skeptical about what they read and what's coming through on their social media feeds. And as you say, Emery, you know, there can be, and hopefully will be, more technological solutions that address it. I know, in addition to people coming up with whitelists and blacklists, which can be controversial as well, at least some of those get translated into now browser extensions that will help you understand if what you're looking at is fake or not. But all I know is that somewhere Andrew Keen, who we've had on the show before, who's the author of The Internet Is Not the Answer, is dancing a jig about all this, because he gets to say a big I told you so, that you know, if you're gonna let Macedonian teens publish something that looks just as credible as ABC News, you know, if you're not going to dig too deeply, then you deserve what you get. Mike, any other thoughts on this?
I'm going to make a prediction that this is ultimately going to be dealt with in the marketplace. I don't see there being a realistic opportunity of Congress coming together and somehow crafting some exception to Section 230 that's going to still provide immunity if you are trying to police for fake news, because then you get into the whole problem of, well, you got Congress passing a content, arguably some sort of content restriction, and giving immunity to certain folks that police for certain content. So it's a thicket when we're talking about this problem up against the First Amendment. So I don't see this, other than Section 230 coming into play to provide immunity to certain service providers. I think that's going to be around, and it should be around. But this is ultimately going to be a problem that Facebook and Google are going to have to tackle on their own in the marketplace and remove the incentives for people to propagate this fake news. And I think that's going to happen in some form or another. Emery may disagree with me, but I guess we'll see.
No, I'm right there with you. I think that this is going to be a market decision rather than any kind of legal decision. I think that's probably better, to be honest.
I think so too. And I think that time is going to help. This is just another episode where people are coming to terms with ways that the internet is out to get them in one way or another. And at the beginning of people being able to shop online, people didn't recognize or realize or didn't have the tools in place to be able to shop securely, and people's credit cards and identities were stolen that way in much larger numbers than we see today. And maybe, you know, as time and best practices continue to work themselves out, maybe that will be a similar solution to the problem we're discussing. I certainly hope so.
Yeah. And I guess in the meantime, Denise, your point about consumers just need to be diligent and kind of like you did. You saw that news story that looked legit, but you cross-referenced and double-checked and realized right away, oh, this was obviously a hoax. So I think people are just going to have to do that until this problem becomes less prevalent.
I don't know, though. On that, just final point on that point, I just have such a problem with placing that responsibility on consumers, given I think that the idea that the work that is required for a consumer to be an informed consumer of the news or of journalism, of science, I think is it's not really feasible anymore.
Right.
Just because the amount of time that it would take to no one can fact check everything that they're reading, you know, it's just not feasible. The problem with science articles, it used to be like, oh, you know, you shouldn't pay attention to what the headline is on the science article. Just go back and read the actual journal, the article, if you want to understand what's going on. And then it's not, you know, now it's, you can't even just read the article, the science journal. You have to actually look at who's funding the science journal to, you know if this is a reputable source. And, you know, it's the chain of how far you have to dig to understand and appreciate maybe bias in media, I think is maybe an insurmountable problem for humans in a global world where we have the internet and where Macedonian teenagers are economically incentivized to pump out, you know, articles that are hardwired to hit that lizard part of your brain. I don't know. Thorny issue.
Right. I totally agree with you, but I think we all agree too that if we're looking around for, okay, what are the solutions, that a legal solution is really difficult.
Yeah. 100% so. Yes.
All right. So in the lack of that, I think, you know, though we can't really expect and probably shouldn't expect too much of people being vigilant and cautious, we can hope. And we can also hope that companies like Facebook and Google will, you know, act against perhaps their countervailing, conflicting interests in having traffic and page views. And
one thing on the market is that, you know, we have this article that has a CBS logo on it, or is a logo that is obviously trying to be the CBS logo.
It was NBC.
You know, a big part of
ABC,
this,
I think it was.
Or ABC, sorry. Yeah. A big problem of this is obviously the, you know, the public's general distrust of the media widely, which is a result of, you know, the 24-hour news cycle and the, you know, degradation of the quality of the news. You would think, or you would hope that ABC, seeing articles like this, would vigorously defend their trademark and would vigorously defend their
name. You would. It all comes back to trademark.
I mean, you know, there are some ways IP can help.
Yes. But again, if the person is somewhere out of the country and not a worthwhile defendant to go after, I think you're just out of luck.
Yeah.
All right. So on that happy note, let us move on. We've talked about the state of news during and post-election. Let's revisit some of the issues that we routinely cover here on This Week in Law. In just a moment, we're going to look at things like net neutrality, the TPP, encryption, et cetera, now that the political landscape has shifted a bit. We're going to look at those in just a bit. But first, we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Braintree. That's code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then you should use the same simple payment solution that helped them become what they are today, shouldn't you? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. And you can add it to your app in just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. So I think this is a great example of what we were just talking about a moment ago, about how far we've come in the world of e-commerce. Just having an HTTPS site is just the beginning of things. You need to also be able to accept many, many forms of payment, and Braintree is your ticket there. If some other way to pay comes along, of course, Braintree is going to support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let us visit the hallowed halls of Congress and the Senate. And various agencies as well, including the FCC. So net neutrality is much on people's minds post-election. What will be the fate of net neutrality? What seems to be the common wisdom is that not too long into the new Republican administration, we're going to see a change in leadership at the FCC and perhaps a shift in the balance of power to where more conservative members are making decisions than we currently see at the FCC right now. So I think this is one reason why people concerned about the fate are concerned about the fate of net neutrality. That and the fact that in one of his, you know, scratch your head to unpack it kind of tweets a while back, Donald Trump equated, I believe it's President Obama's position on various internet issues. I don't think he mentioned net neutrality specifically with the resurrection of the Fairness Act and implying that certain things that had happened in the Obama administration, perhaps net neutrality among them, might be going to change on his watch. So I would point out there's a point, an article in Forbes that Larry Downs authored, that there's really not much you can say except to guess that, yeah, we're going to see this shift and maybe things will change. There's nothing concrete right now to talk about on this, but people, there is a lot of hand-wringing in process. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I don't actually have that much to add. I think that Larry Downs probably hit the nail on the head. But I do want to caution against maybe downplaying the concern too much. You know, this is I should say that, you know, in 2008 when the FCC was transitioning again previously, you know, before Obama took power or, became president, when he was just president-elect, they similarly sent a letter to the FCC asking them to hold off on implementing any controversial, new rules, and that the FCC would see new leadership soon. So the fact that, you know, the FCC, Tom Wheeler has gotten a letter urging the FCC to not implement any controversial rules now is not unheard of. It's not really surprising. But it is something to keep in mind that, you know, Tom Wheeler has actually, I think, much to some people's surprise, been really excellent for net neutrality, for the open internet, for privacy. And there's a whole host of regulations that a lot of people have been working on very hard for many years, going to lots and lots of multi-stakeholder task meetings and submitting comments and briefs and amici that might not get passed.
Right.
As new leadership comes into the FCC, this is always the risk of, you know, using the FCC and using these department's rules as, the fundamental way to protect the internet, or the fundamental way to protect free speech or privacy. They can always just be wiped away with the next administration. So I think that Larry Downs is right, that net neutrality isn't immediately on the chopping block, despite what The Verge says. But that being said, we have a president-elect who has on Twitter said that he doesn't believe in this policy and he thinks that it's harmful. And we have, you know, this president-elect is campaigned on change and we don't know what's going to happen down the pike. So yeah, it's, you know, if you're interested in any of these regulations that are going to be putting more privacy protections on ISPs, that are, you know, there to ensure that the internet remains open and that ISPs can't, you know, discriminate access to the internet in certain ways, you want to be paying close attention to this. The FCC position is very important. There's a lot of stuff that's going on in that area right now. And it's in flux. So, you know, the FCC is currently in sort of a power grab to try to bring broadband internet access service providers under more strict regulations about how they control and what they do with customer privacy information. You know, this is something that I really support, that we're not, you know, it's not nearly as clear and set as it was a couple of months ago. So.
Right. Mike, any thoughts on net neutrality?
Nothing further here. We'll just have to wait and see what President-elect Trump does with cyber.
Yep. All right. One thing that we think we know what President-elect Trump, what his course is going to be. And in fact, the EFF has come out and said we officially today declare the TPP dead, is we don't think that America, the United States of America, will be signing on to the TPP. Certainly something that Trump campaigned against rather vehemently. And so you might think, because if you followed along with our discussions on the show and the experts that we've had on over the last few years to talk about the TPP and what we knew about it, what we didn't know about it, there were and still are for other countries is the kicker, provisions in it that are problematic from an intellectual property standpoint. As the EFF puts it, the other TPP countries are still in the process of passing their implementing legislation, which contains all of the worst measures in the TPP that we have been fighting against for the last 6 years, including the extension of the term of copyright, the strict rules against DRM circumvention, the tough criminal penalties against those who infringe copyright or leak trade secrets, and the prohibition against mandates to review source code for bugs and backdoors. Countries that continue along the path of passing their implementing legislation will end up in the worst of all possible worlds, having accepted all the U.S. demands on copyright and other digital policies, but without receiving any trade benefits from the United States in exchange. So
that's good business.
Yeah, I guess it is good business. We've exported, we've managed to, by putting these things in the TPP or in our contributions to the TPP, exported some of the most controversial parts of our IP law to other countries, which the EFF promises to continue to follow and work against. So if you're concerned about those things, the EFF are people you want to be supporting. Mike, any thoughts on this?
Nothing really comes to mind. It's more of a wait and see. It'll be interesting to see what happens under the new administration.
Yep. Absolutely. And Emery, TPP thoughts before we move on?
Nothing really. You know, I think the EFF hit it on the head. It's a little unfortunate. I mean, obviously there are a lot of differing opinions about the TPP. I think economists tend to think that it's great. I think that IP attorneys tend to think that it is worrisome, especially the ones that aren't the copyright maximalists. So, you know, to see that basically the provisions of the TPP that the IP guys were concerned about is, you know, basically going out without a hitch around the world, but, you know, they're not going to see any of the benefits of it is, it's a bummer. It's not that surprising.
All right. And another very hot button issue that was again commented upon by President-elect Trump during the campaign is the question of encryption. What sort of government actions will or may be taken to limit and restrict encryption, whether backdoors will be mandatory. Folks may remember that Donald Trump was not happy with Apple when it decided to take a stand against the FBI in connection with the San Bernardino terrorist event that happened. Gosh, was that just early this year? Came out and chastised Apple and encouraged people to boycott Apple products. because he didn't care for Apple standing up for user privacy and for its own business interests in being able to design a product that could give users at least some assurance of their privacy. As far as we don't know, as we sit here today on so many of these things, what President-elect Trump's policies will be, because on the cyber, he has been fairly opaque. We don't have a detailed point by point, you know, here's what we intend to do about these issues.
It's almost like the debates didn't ask anything relevant.
It's almost like that. Right.
Well, almost certainly. Like that. We just had an entire election without any good questions being asked at any of the debates or any of the coverage. How infuriating and insane would that be? I'm sorry.
I know. I forget who tweeted this, but I retweeted it without fact checking it, by the way. the week that someone had tweeted how if you think you live in a bubble, just consider that I, being the person who tweeted this, occupy a Twitter feed where people think the election would turn on issues involving copyright. And of course, that's probably never going to happen. And encryption probably falls into that basket of important things too.
Or the environment. Not a single question on the environment or on cybersecurity in any fundamental real way. It's pretty depressing. But yeah, I think that a lot of people are still reeling about what a Trump presidency means for encryption. I think that... you know, one of the last article I said was a little bit of hand-wringing about net neutrality. I think that this is a little less of a hand-wringing issue just because of, this is something that I don't think Trump understands at all, at all. And I think that the people that he's appointing have been solidly in the camp of criminalizing end-to-end encryption, requiring backdoors. I think that that's certainly coming down the pike. I would not be at all surprised to see, you know, that argument being pushed heavily, heavily over the next couple of years.
I would not either. And I think that people need to be really aware of that and vigilant. And if they're concerned about having secure communications and privacy.
Keep in mind, there is nothing that could be less effective than a war on encryption. It is like the dumbest thing you could ever do as a law to pass. We talked about this before, but I mean, everything's open source and known and out there, and people rely on them already. The tools are already built. The technology is there. You can't make it illegal and expect people not to be able to get to it. But what does that mean for software sellers in America? Does that mean that, you know, you're going to have all of your software, if you want to sell legally, be signed by some kind of government key, or you're going to have some kind of government backdoor? I think that there's a real possibility that we're going to see movement in that direction in the next 4 years, which is super scary, especially given some of the articles that we're not going to get to talk about today. But there's a great study on internet freedom by freedomhouse.org that I encourage everyone to check out.
Yeah, well, I don't want to talk about it in too much detail, but I did see that in your Twitter feed this week, Emery, and it looks definitely well worth looking at in detail. And one of the points that's made there is globally the increase in restrictions on internet-based messaging and calling services due to their strong privacy and security features, which have attracted many users amid growing concerns about surveillance worldwide. So definitely check out the Freedom
These
House
tools that, you know,
report.
When you require Facebook to, you know, if you require Apple to give up the keys to the FBI, if you require Facebook to give up the identity of users to the NSA, what's going to happen is the same thing is going to happen in China and in Turkey and in Syria and in Iran. And it's going to result in, you know, 20-year-old kids getting thrown in prison for years. You know, people rely on these tools to do good and to do things that we all support. And, you know, activists rely on these tools in America and around the country, around the world. It's very alarming, very scary. I don't consider this hand-wringing at all. I think that this is just like, you know, threats to the environment with dismantling the EPA. Like, this is real threat. This is really something to be concerned about. So pay close attention to this, please, everyone.
Yeah. And here we actually have some more concrete indication of what President-elect Trump is likely to do. I mean, saying boycott Apple, this is a wrong position that they're taking, is a pretty clear telegraph of what he wants companies and private services to do vis-a-vis the government. Whereas, and it's quite a departure from what we saw on the other side, where Hillary Clinton seemed to be a bit befuddled about, oh, well, shouldn't we be able to accomplish both goals, national security and privacy? And while that's a nice situation to hope we could accomplish, technologists were wringing their hands and throwing them up in frustration that she was not getting the fact that once you backdoor or compromise something, privacy goes out the window. So, Mike, any thoughts on encryption?
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of issues that, you know, both outside of the context and what we're talking about, you know, with President-elect Trump, I think the key is going to be, you know, the advisors that he surrounds himself with. And, you know, he's shown throughout the campaign that he has not necessarily a real nuanced view on a lot of issues, this being one of them. And hopefully when he starts to assemble his cabinet and other advisors, you know, people will be able to prevail upon him and show that, you know, this isn't as black and white as he'd like to think it is. It's obviously a very important issue. I would be surprised personally if he takes on this issue, certainly early on in the administration. I think he's got other things that he's, you know, committed to, healthcare and tax reform and some of these other big ticket items. But obviously a very important issue. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yes, and I think it too will depend somewhat on what sort of world events take place in the next several months. I mean, the only reason Donald Trump saw fit to weigh in on the Apple issue is because terrorism was involved. So we'll have to see.
I mean,
if there's,
you know, it only the worst of these laws are always passed because of terrorism or child pornography. You know,
right?
This is I don't think that terrorism is going away anytime soon either. So yeah, it's less of an if, more of a win.
Yes. We have Brad Young, the Assistant General Counsel at TripAdvisor, and Laurent Crenshaw, the Director of Public Policy at Yelp, in an op-ed at The Hill, urging a couple of items that are pending to get signed by President Obama before January, and that would be the Consumer Review Fairness Act, and also the Speak Free Act. They're arguing in their op-ed, we've talked about the Consumer Review Fairness Act, at least on the show before. That is the one that requires, forbids non-disparagement clauses in contracts with service providers. So you go to your doctor or your tree trimmer or whoever, and you sign their contract. If there's hidden language in there that says you may not negatively review us, that's going to be invalid under this law if it passes. And also the Speak Free Act, also something that could get approved in the next couple of months here, is a federal anti-SLAPP law. So many, many states have anti-SLAPP laws preventing strategic lawsuits against public participation. That's what SLAPP stands for, where a lawsuit is brought not so much because you've been injured, but because you are trying to quell someone's speech. We would have a federal standard for that if the Speak Free Act is passed. So both of those are possibilities to be signed into law. Again, we don't know what then Congress would do after January 21st if Congress would think that those are bad laws and they should be rolled back. But right now, we've got these folks from TripAdvisor and Yelp, and I'm sure many, many other companies that deal with interacting with the public and letting people give honest reviews of services, hoping that both these laws pass. Mike, you want to weigh in on this one?
I'm a big proponent of this proposed legislation. It's passed in the state of California, called the Right to Yelp Law, informally, which restricts people from, you know, having these gag clauses. I was actually on a panel last week in Minneapolis with an in-house lawyer from the Mayo Clinic, and he had told the audience about how some doctors, not associated with the clinic, but some doctors had had patients assign their rights to the doctors to any negative reviews that they would post. Jesus. Or any reviews that would post. And so what happened is these doctors would then send DMCA takedown notices for negative reviews, saying that they own the copyright in those reviews. So that's kind of a clever way of getting around some of the legal issues associated with a takedown notice. It's not in the context of copyright. So
I'm sorry, Mike, you just pronounced clever. I think you pronounced disgusting incorrectly. I heard clever, maybe. Did you mean to say abhorrent?
Abhorrently clever, I suppose, and abhorrent. So we don't want that type of, the public needs to be informed of what's going on with goods and services. And I think these statutes are dead on. We shouldn't have these gag clauses in commercial contracts.
Yep.
Emery, you're on board?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on board. Okay. I mean, first off, how could I not be on? Well, I say that, but you've got to love the acronym that they went with, the Securing Participation, Engagement, and Knowledge Freedom by Reducing Egregious Efforts Act, or Speak Free. I'm just picturing the person typing that away on their computer and choking to themselves.
There is a real skill to coming up with those.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think that, just like you said, these benefit consumers and businesses alike, because all the doctors that aren't doing this are able to rely on the fact that the reviews for these bad doctors are truthful and pushing them towards the good doctors. This is a crucial need in the 21st century for people to have forums to review.
Right.
And the idea that you're assigning your future reviews by going to the doctor's insane.
Yes. All right. I have to just end.
The other side of the equation here is that people feel not very constrained sometimes to provide an online review that's just false. And so I can understand the reason why these merchants would and other purveyors of goods and services would want to have these provisions. But it's kind of one of those things that it goes with the territory. People are not going to be happy with your services sometimes. And maybe you, instead of having gag clauses, you've got to redouble your efforts to, try to appease them or make them apologize if they weren't happy with your services, and try to correct it if you can. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. I had to end our legislation, regulation, and policy discussion today with a return to ballot selfies, which we were discussing a lot before the election, where they are okay, where they are not. They are not okay in New York, but that didn't stop Eric Trump, who tweeted a ballot selfie. And then somebody must have told him, hey, that's not legal in this state, because he then took it down. So the same guy who also decided to use photographer David Kitos's picture of a bowl of Skittles without the photographer's permission or a license, and then had it removed from Twitter and found himself subject to a lawsuit, which is still pending on the copyright issues involved there, also had to remove his ballot selfie from Twitter. So we probably won't be concerned with ballot selfies again for at least another 4 years. So I just thought we'd have a little footnote to that discussion. Any thoughts, guys, before we move on?
No, I wish he had. I don't know. I've got no love for the Trumps, obviously, but I wish he had kept it up out of, what's the word I'm looking for?
If he cares about ballot selfies and changing the law in the state of New York, yes, that would have been a good thing to do.
Yeah.
I don't understand. What was the copyright issue?
It wasn't a copyright issue. It was, an issue about voter intimidation.
I thought somebody had mentioned that there was a copyright issue associated with
that. I was referencing back to something else we've discussed on the show recently, and that is it was also Eric Trump that tweeted something along the lines of he was using a bowl of Skittles as a metaphor.
That was Donald Trump Jr.
Never mind. Thanks for fact checking me.
No problem. No problem.
Yes. Donald Trump Jr., Skittles, Eric. So Eric had the ballot selfie, but no Skittles. Bear that in mind, folks. Bear that in mind. All right. Let us move on in just a moment to talk about cars. Not so much. Well, we'll discuss whether we think car law is going to change under the new political dynamics in the U.S. I suppose we can touch on that, too. But before we get to talking about cars, let's thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. FreshBooks is what I use in my law practice to get my invoices out the door, and I am a solo practitioner, so and I have no staff. So this is a tool that lets me get paid and makes it very easy for me. And it's just a wonderful way to accomplish that task that can be quite a drudge if you're not using FreshBooks. FreshBooks has launched an all-new version of their cloud accounting software. It's been redesigned from the ground up and custom-built for freelancers and small business owners. FreshBooks has created a super intuitive tool that makes it easy to create and send professional-looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. You can easily customize your invoice with your logo, color scheme, or any image that reflects your brand. Chat with your client regarding an invoice once they receive it. You'll be able to see what invoices have been sent, which ones have been viewed, and also which ones have been paid, as well as which ones are overdue and outstanding. So you know you need to follow up on those. The modern and simplified dashboard works as the hub of your business, answering the most important question, how is my business doing? You'll have quick access to outstanding balances, spending, total profit, and accounting reports like sales tax summary and profit and loss. Tracking expenses is as easy as taking a photo of your receipt using the FreshBooks app. Track expenses by vendor and by category. Time tracking makes it easier to bill for your time by client and by specific projects. Easily start your timer and track your time to the minute. When it comes time to create an invoice, you'll know what you did and when you did it, and it will get captured and immediately dropped in there for you. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive and organized. Most importantly, get paid quickly. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to our audience here at This Week in Law. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/twill and enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for supporting this episode of This Week in Law. So let's move on to cars. And of course, when we talk about cars here on the show, we usually talk about the ones that drive themselves and have some degree of artificial intelligence. So we're going to talk about that just briefly today, the autonomous car ethics question, the question that we've talked about from the folks at MIT, Moral Machine, I believe, is the program we've highlighted before, where you can answer questions about who you think the car should hit and for what reason. A couple of people tweeted at me before this show to highlight the fact that we've had a few more officials and luminaries in the United States weigh in on this issue. Chris Gerdes, Chief Technology Officer for the U.S. Department of Transportation, and Patrick Lin, Director of Ethics and Emerging Sciences at Cal Poly, have both discussed it. There was, I think, a Fortune-sponsored confab in L.A. where folks got together to chew on this. And Professor Lin says, if you program a collision, that means it's premeditated. Is that even legal? This is all untested law. So I don't believe any of these folks have arrived at any conclusions, but we're bringing it up just to let you know there's a good piece in Fortune on the whole issue, and that folks are still grappling with who should hit whom in their self-driving car. And whether you really, you know, as Lynn says, if you're programming a collision, and it seems that these cars are going to have to be programmed with that in mind, that there are some thorny legal and ethical issues you're going to have to deal with. But also, as the Fortune article points out, as cars remove some of the human dangers from driving, perhaps it's all a wash. Emery, anything you want to add?
I mean, I think that this is admiring the problem a little bit. It's, you know, you're going to program the car to drive as good as possible. The car is going to be programmed to follow the rules of the road and to drive on the road correctly. I think that we've seen that 90% or more of problems on the road are human error. So I think that it's probably going to drive down the number of accidents that are ever caused or on the road. But I mean, in the event of an accident, I mean, this is why the trolley problem is a hypothetical, because you don't have, like, you as a human aren't making a rational choice if you get in an accident and you have to immediately choose between, you know, A decision or B decision. You know, you're just firing on, you know, pure adrenaline and like fear as you're gripping the wheel and, you know, trying not to kill yourself. I think that it's more likely that the cars are just going to be programmed to be the best drivers possible and to, you know, minimize accidents. And if any accident occurs, then yeah, look at the root cause of the problem. You know, it's not the, you don't expect your car to make an ethical choice. You expect your car to make the correct choice.
Right. Mike, anything to add?
Well, but what is the correct choice? I mean, it's very difficult because, you know, as we all experienced when we used that piece of software that you mentioned, Denise, and kind of went through and tried to make the decision as to whether we should try to save the passengers in our car or hit the sole pedestrian. You know, I mean, there are going to be choices, I presume, factored in into the software. If the car knows that it has five passengers in the car, and it has the choice of hitting potentially a single pedestrian and saving the lives of the passengers, you know, maybe the programmers are going to make sure that it makes that decision. So I agree with you, Emery, that it's going to be programmed to make the correct decision, but I think it begs the question, what is the correct decision?
I guess my point is that I don't think that it's – I feel like it's a fake scenario though, right? I mean, because it's not like the car is making that calculated decision. It's saying I'm driving on the road. The road is in front of me. There's a thing that happens to me. I can no longer stop. And then it's just responding to that, right? So – I mean, is that a pre-programmed decision to then weigh the costs and benefits of the lives of the people in the car versus the life of the person that it may be running into? Or is it just a matter of the car is supposed to be on the road following these rules and now it is no longer on the road and it is responding, trying to get back on the road?
Code is law.
Right.
In that case.
I would think this just instinctually, if any of us are driving our car and we're faced with a scenario, we're going to do what we think in that split second is going to be best for us in that scenario and our passengers. Yeah. And yeah. So it strikes me that that's not necessarily, you know, programming an artificial intelligence vehicle to make a similar type of human-like decision. I mean, that doesn't strike me as particularly problematic.
I mean, right. The idea that, you know, you also have everyone, the reason that works is because everyone's operating on their own self-interest theoretically, right? Like everyone is following the rules, and that's why, you know, if they get in an accident, yeah, they're thinking out, you know, for themselves, but ideally everyone's following the same rules so the accidents don't occur. I think that, you know, once the car automation boom hits and it's going to hit big, it's probably going to be a very different discussion that we're having once we realize how much of a reduction in accidents we're actually seeing.
All right, so we talked about concerns related to self-driving cars. There was some news this week related to cars that are merely quiet. And before we get into that, I'm going to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show, which relates to that story. And the phrase is going to be, car sounds like Yoko. And you'll see why in just a second. If you are a lawyer or other professional person who likes to listen to our show or watch our show for professional credit in your field, we put these in so you can demonstrate that you actually watched or listened in case you need to show someone that. If you want some more information about that, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our show This Week in Law. And for the lawyer types out there, we've got a chart of the 50 United States and their various CLE requirements and how you might go about putting the show into them. So what did get determined is that, and this has been in the works for a while, there's been a concern that electric cars are too quiet and pose a danger to pedestrians. So now we have rules that Congress have approved to add sounds to all vehicles by September 2019. Automakers didn't like this too much. They had raised concerns about the alerts, saying they are too loud and complicated. The rules set minimum sound requirements, but do not specify what sounds must be omitted and emitted. And of course, the Trump administration could decide that this is the kind of regulation on automakers in the United States that they want to get rid of, that no, you should be able to have a quiet car if you want to. But what's better than that under the current rules as promulgated, and the fact that they're vague about what sort of noises cars must make now, as long as this law remains in effect or these rules remain in effect. Over at Gizmodo, Sophie Kleeman has a piece titled "Electric Cars Must Now Make Noise," and we have some suggestions. I was hoping somebody would do this, and she has offered various suggestions as to what cars might sound like, such as Yoko Ono's scream therapy, the Simpsons electric car of the future. Speaking of screams, maybe Howard Dean's scream would be a good one. An air horn. Yes, very good Dean impression.
That was pretty good,
Emery.
Yeah,
I like that. I'm surprised you remember Howard Dean. That was a while ago. Various suggestions and memes that could be incorporated into automakers' compliance with this rule. And I certainly, for one, hope that at least a few of them are. Anything to add, Emery?
I just want to echo Elgato in the chat that I really hope these are customizable, because I want my car to make impulse sounds as it's driving really slowly, you know? Pew, pew, pew.
Yes, you should have a whole dashboard of sounds your car could play, right? Given the circumstances.
Yeah, on the idea that if they are potentially customizable, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. The fact that it's so much fun makes me think there's no way in hell that it's going to be customizable, which is a bit of a bummer. But, you know, I think it's a good law.
Oh, there will be some kind of hack.
Yeah.
Stay hopefully. Tuned for that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mike, anything on quiet cars or noisy cars or Yoko cars?
Well, I can just imagine a whole new cottage industry here. Cartoons, right? Or cartones. Where, you know, instead of ringtones, you've got
the trademark office to get that.
Yep. Register the domain. Go. That's a good one. All right. Where were we going to go after cars? Let's entertain ourselves a bit, shall we?
Yes.
All right. So, like I said, we haven't done a show in a couple of weeks here. We took last week off on Veterans Day. So you may have already seen Hoshino. But if not, I want to alert you to the fact that there is this wonderful Star Wars fan film out there called Hoshino, Hoshino, that is just a great example of directors, you know, very professional directors and actors and things, writers. Let's tell you who's working on Hoshino here. Director Steven Vital, who has experience at Amblin and DreamWorks, etc. Emmy-nominated composer and grandson of the original trilogy music supervisor.
Wow.
Yes. A writer from the CW Supergirl, and a visual effects team with talent in both practical and digital effects, not to mention two primary actors who it feels like should be getting calls from Lucasfilm any minute now. I'm reading from the comicbook.com coverage of Hoshino. So if you haven't seen it, we'll just sit back and give you a little Hoshino right now to tantalize yourself.
Master Jiansu, when are we moving on to lightsabers?
That is not the right question. You should be asking what is unique about a lightsaber, what is essential.
Okay, I'm not going to show you much more than this in case
we'll get a DMCA takedown ourselves.
Yes. Well, no, I'm not so much worried about that. We're doing commentary here. And the commentary has to do with the fact that this is out and available and Lucasfilm is not doing any lightsaber or other rattling about it. And in fact, the comicbook.com piece that we have in our discussion points for today specifically says, thanks to the support of Lucasfilm, we've got another level of production quality, et cetera, for this particular film and Star Wars fan films in general. I think implying there that Lucasfilm tends to be fairly embracing of these kinds of things. And in fact, they have a whole fan film competition that happened earlier this year that this did not get entered into. But they do seem to be more encouraging of these kinds of projects than, say, Paramount and CBS when it comes to Star Trek. And I definitely want to encourage folks to take a look at Hoshino if they haven't already done so. It's very well done. Any thoughts, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, definitely encourage people to check it out. I hadn't heard about this when you linked it, so it was great to sort of stumble on this last night while preparing for the show. But it's awesome. Definitely check it out. Super high production quality. Yeah, it's really great. It is encouraging. You know, to backtrack just a bit when you're talking about LucasArts being pretty permissive, I think that, yeah, that's something worth keeping in mind that, you know, not Disney, but LucasArts in particular with Star Wars has sort of a history of being more permissive with their use. Well, I say that, but there's Star Wars parody case. But regardless, you know, there are things like the 501st Vader's Legion. They recognize that the fan community is the lifeblood of their work, and it's what, you know, makes Star Wars a success in 2016. You know, after the disaster of the prequels, you know, people love the stuff, and if you let people love it, then I think that it pays dividends. You know, I think this is really exciting though because there's so much. It's not just permission. It seems like they've got, you know, maybe some assets from LucasArts, or, you know, at the very least, it's like the production quality on this is great. It's so high that it really, I think, pushes up against the maybe the traditional narrative that fan films would never be mistaken for the work that they are homaging or borrowing from or being a derivative work from because of the quality of the production is always so obvious. You know, as it gets easier and more affordable for smaller groups to make really high quality pieces like this, it brings into question that whole discussion.
Which argues either in favor of being permissive about it, like Lucasfilm seems to be being here, or for the fair use doctrine to have to come to grips with maybe there is room for something like this still to be fair use, even though it might actually be competing with actual Lucasfilm product, which is something that is usually taken as a factor against applying the fair use doctrine. Mike, anything?
Yes. Yeah, so I, like both of you, I loved this, and I wasn't aware until I reviewed this and did a little bit of research as to how supportive Lucasfilms is of these fan films. There's been a contest going back, I think, into the early 2000s, like 2002. There are certain rules associated with these fan submissions, and Lucasfilms actually licenses. Yeah, so Lucasfilms actually licenses some of the sounds and some of the IP so that these fans can make their films. And I read the rules earlier this morning, and there's actually in them a reference to Star Trek, and it says you cannot use any Star Trek assets or something to that effect in your fan film. So I think this is just and it's got to be a certain length. It used to be 15 minutes. It went to 10, and now I think it's 5 in order to be considered for the award ceremony. And they give out like 7 or 8 different awards, you know, best picture, best, you know, cinematography, so on and so forth. So it sounds like it kind of mimics to an extent Academy Awards. But I thought this was just a brilliant way to harness the enthusiasm of users. You're not squelching anything. As a matter of fact, you're being creative and allowing them to be creative. And interestingly enough, if and when you submit your your film to Lucasfilms or Disney or whoever exactly you're submitting it to, in the agreement, you give them a license to reproduce it and use it as they wish. So, you know, it struck me as not only a brilliant way to support fan films and continue to create interest and buzz about the Star Wars films, but mm-hmm. you know, you might also get some pretty good ideas from some of these really smart fans that are doing some neat things. So,
right. Well, I think this whole
win-win. It's a win-win-win situation all the way around, and you know, I think this is kind of like the picture-perfect example of how you should treat fan films.
Both in the context of their competition, which I don't think Hoshino could be part of because it's too long and probably violates various of the other rules. And in the context of other fan films like Hoshino, where, you know, here I think I don't believe the character existed until this film was made. And it's a tantalizing character. So again, even though they don't have the license to it, et cetera, because it wasn't part of their competition. Certainly some productive talks could take place, I would assume, between Lucasfilm and the Hoshino folks about incorporating Hoshino into the canon. What were you going to say, Emery?
Well, I guess I've got to follow up on your point, but basically my question was, I'd like to throw this out to Mike and you guys. I mean, on the one hand, yes, this is in many ways a picture-perfect example of how a company should work with their fans to permit awesome fan films and fan work. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I mean, this sort of reminds me of the Paramount rules against Star Trek fan works. You know, how they say, okay, we're not going to be shutting down you guys. We acknowledge that you are a vital part of our community. So we're just going to put out some guidelines on how you can, you know, make your own fan works. And the guidelines were ridiculous. And, you know, as much as I agree that this is a great way for LucasArts/Disney to work with their fans, on the other hand, it is a little disappointing, I think, or it's not ideal in my mind that the copyright holder gets to determine the extent to which their fan works can be made. You know, I don't know. I guess I wanted to throw that out to you guys to see what your thoughts are with that side of this argument. Because, like, for example, you know, with the idea that this is like a really interesting character, how exactly are IP rights in the character in this fan work divided? Given that there is certainly LucasArts assets in the, you know, in the work, is there some kind of like dual licensorship or licensing or dual ownership, joint ownership? I mean, what is, you know what I mean? Like if there were more hardline rules, more guidelines exactly, mm-hmm. like that said that, for example, you know, you have more freedom to make a derivative work that is fair use or, you know, whatever. If we expand the fair use to more completely or more clearly allow for derivative works like this, then the copyright in that character would be Stephen Vitale's. In which mm-hmm. case, if, you know, LucasArts wanted to introduce Hoshino into the Star Wars canon in the next Rogue One movie or whatever, they'd have to be dealing with Steven. I'm not sure how that plays out with these kind of licensed fan works. Do you have any idea and, I guess, perspective on what I've just said?
Well, I don't think this one is licensed. So I think
I keep calling it LucasArts, not Lucasfilm. Sorry.
That's okay. I think they'd have to. I mean, I think you're on to something with, can you create a copyright in a character, in a universe, you know, put a new character into an existing copyrighted universe of characters and expect to have a unique copyright in that character such that if you are Stephen Vital, you get to say, okay, Lucasfilm, if you want to use Hoshino in future works, you have to come to me and I have to license her to you. I don't know if it's that black and white, but it might be. And what were you going to say, Mike?
Yeah, that's actually a fairly tricky issue. Uh-huh. Stephen Vitale would only have copyright in his original elements of expression. And a lot of what has been used here is really a copy of some of the pre-existing works, you know, the Jedi Knights, the Big Brown, the wardrobes, the lightsabers, obviously the sound effects, all of which were used. So a lot of the elements of the film would not be original to Stephen Vitale, but he would you would have copyright protection in those original elements. So, but it just wouldn't include a lot of the Star Wars elements that he copied.
Yeah.
So how would you break down the ownership of the character of Hoshino, who is, I mean, fundamentally a blind Jedi, but also is her own character that, you know, has obviously she's, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers, you know, but she is her own character with her own motivations and, you know, wants and story for those kind of characters that are inseparable from the works that they are, you know, born from, you know, it's, I don't know, throwing that out there. What do you think?
Right. I mean, what Vitaly would claim, of course, is that, look, the original elements of Hoshino, you know, she's a blind Jedi, a female warrior, you know, that she's got this unique and original appearance. She's obviously had some sort of injury that's befallen her. And the plot associated with that is probably protectable expression. But you'd have to subtract out the elements that weren't original to Steven, i.e. the various lightsabers, the wardrobe, the ships that fly over at the outset, you know, things like that that just wouldn't be protectable. But I'm with you, Emery. It's always, especially when you come to copyright protection for characters and plots and themes, it's tricky.
Right.
It's tricky. You notice, to separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will.
You notice that Steven Vitale, you know, I'm sure was well aware that there was a Star Wars fan film competition sponsored by Lucasfilm that he could have complied with and participated in, and chose not to go that route, probably because he didn't want to license this original character to Lucasfilm without further discussion, and particularly how's that going to play out compensation wise. Which people who enter these kinds of things and grant those sort of blanket licenses need to bear in mind. You know, if you've come up with something so powerful that Lucasfilm wants to use it, and you've given them a blanket license and everything you've submitted, you can be proud, but I don't know if you can be paid. So something to bear in mind. And I love that you brought up that, Mike, that Lucasfilm anticipated that people immediately when they're creating want to mash things up with Star Trek, because that's our next story. Here there is a Kickstarter book that was going to be a Dr. Seuss Star Trek mashup. However, they have been withdrawn from Kickstarter and also sued by the rights holders of Dr. Seuss because it was too close to the copyrighted material. Mike, you have more thoughts about this?
Until I read the show notes, I was actually not familiar with this filing. I know it's just from, you know, a few days ago. So I was delighted to read it. It certainly brought to mind a prior lawsuit involving Dr. Seuss where I forget the name of the alleged parody. I know Emery knows. The Cat Not in the Hat by Dr. Juice. Alleged parody of the Cat in the Hat, as told by Dr. Juice, I think O.J. Simpson, or it's about the O.J. Simpson murder trial. A case that went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit said, "Look, this is not fair use. You're not commenting or critiquing the original. You're kind of copying the original in a funny way." But it has nothing to do with, you commenting on that original work by Dr. Seuss. So it wasn't protected as a fair use of those assets.
Right. Here, the book in question is called Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go. And the publisher, or the would-be publisher, Comic Mix, has already raised nearly $30,000 in investment and hopes to ship the book in time for the holiday season. Doesn't look the way things stand now like that's going to happen. Although I don't know if there's an injunction in place that prevents them from going forward. As you say, Mike, I think the suit was just filed. So we'll have to see what happens there. But who doesn't want to see Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go?
But yeah, and I'm inspired. I'm already going to work on a blog post about this case, so stay tuned.
Are the pun engines just like spinning right now? I can imagine.
Right.
The second I saw it, they started.
Right. Yeah. We're going to make Who Owns Hoshino our second MCLE passphrase for the show, if you are keeping track of those. And we're going to end the show on a couple of copyright stories. So first, back into the political arena real quick before we move on to something non-political. The Trump transition website, Mike Masnick has picked apart pretty extensively in a post on TechDirt called Trump Transition Website Has Some Copyright Problems, both in copying content and in claiming copyright. This is greatagain.gov, which they quickly got up there. Which seems to have wholesale taken portions of the website for the Center for Presidential Transition, which is put out by the Partnership for Public Service, which is appears to be a nonprofit. It's got a .org, and I think I've seen its representatives in a nonpartisan way discussing the transition on various news broadcasts. So the Trump campaign, however, though, are now no longer a Trump campaign, the transition team that is in place to assist the president-elect in gearing up to govern has big hunks of text that have been lifted from this other website referencing aspects of the other website that aren't there, charts that that should be there that aren't included, and then talking about our own center library, meaning the site that the text was lifted from and not actually the Trump transition team. There's also an interesting thing that Mike points out that despite the fact that there seems to have been wholesale copying from this other site, the Trump team has also applied a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license for works that are posted on greatagain.gov. Of course, you cannot license things in which you do not own the copyright. So the things that they wholesale copied wouldn't be effectively licensed under this Creative Commons license. Although if you were just looking at them, you wouldn't necessarily know that without doing a whole bunch of research. So it seems like greatagain.gov has stumbled into a couple of copyright thickets. Emery, any thoughts?
Oh, you know, this is I didn't expect this to be huge news that's going to shock the world. But, you know, it's sort of the kind of thing that made last week a little more tolerable for IP junkies like myself. It's like, OK, well, at least I can dig into some copyright questions here. I just think that one of the things that's sort of interesting is the question of whether or not this transition website is a work of the federal government and maybe deserving of copyright at all.
Yes.
You know, as obviously, as we've talked before, works of the federal government are not copyrightable. But what does that mean for a president-elect transition team? It has a .gov web address, for example, but they're not technically the government, are they? Question mark. You know, interesting stuff to think about.
Right. Again, this is really more for the law professors in our audience. I think they could make a whole bunch of hay about this one. And for the rest of us concerned with practical, important issues, there aren't too many here, right? The center that was copied is probably not going to sue. The question of whether, I don't know, I mean, maybe someone decides to make a mashup of this site and relies on the Creative Commons license. But even then, the only alternate argument there is it's either pretty liberally licensed or it's public domain as a government site, right? So if you want to make a mashup of greatagain.gov, you're probably going to be able to do it either way. Mike?
Just a couple of things. Right. I think it's an interesting question about whether there's even copyright protection for this site. Of course, as I understand it, there is a whole federal statute on presidential transitional teams, you know, once you're elected. And so I don't know if they are actually government employees at this point. Maybe they are. And if they are, then there wouldn't be any copyright protection associated with it. The other thing, though, we've seen throughout the campaign that the Trump campaign and some of the individuals that are closely tied and associated with that campaign, there's been lots of interesting copyright issues. You recall we had the issue with Melania Trump earlier this summer. We then had the Donald J. Trump Jr. Skittles tweet that ultimately resulted in a copyright infringement suit. There was a claim of infringement with respect to a bald eagle that the Trump campaign used. And now, of course, we've got the greatagain.gov snafu. So, yeah, it's been fun from a copyright perspective to see what these folks are up to.
Yes. And now we must discuss parrots. Jonathan Annett wrote to me going, I hope you've seen this and I hope you can work it into the show. And on first glance, neither he nor I saw how we could do that because there didn't appear to be a copyright question. It's just a really funny tweet by a lawyer. Lady Loya turns out to have been the author of this actual tweet. And she tweeted on September 15th of this year, just settled a divorce over parrot custody / visitation. Neither may teach it negative phrases about the other. I went to law school for this. So this thing went viral. Unfortunately, it didn't go viral when Lady Loya tweeted it. It went viral apparently when Michael Adler did, who's another lawyer who maybe has just forgotten or never been taught how to RT, but instead of RTing her tweet, tweeted it verbatim in a way that made it appear to be his own, inspiring much ire from the internet, who called him on it and said, hey, you know, this is someone else's tweet, and let her know about that. So that we actually get to talk about it on the show, because it turns out the funny tweet was plagiarized. So I guess this sort of harkens back to the fake news discussion we were having earlier. It went viral the second time around, and it took people fact-checking the tweet that they were looking at to figure out, oh, yeah, this guy isn't actually the author. It's this other person over here, Lady Loya. So folks are fact-checking, Emery. They caught
the lawyers
it.
Are fact checking. Good.
Yeah. Exactly. I didn't really hone in on that particular variable here. Mike, any thoughts?
Nothing further. It's a pretty comical yes. story, I thought.
She doesn't seem to have DMCA'd her Michael Adler, her copier, but she could.
She has pinned it, and I saw another tweet from hers that says that she's very tired of parrots. So I assume that she's getting probably barraged by people going, hey, did you know? So
absolutely. And then I guess we could also sort of throw into the mix here the whole copyrightability of a tweet issue.
Yes.
If she were to send a DMCA takedown notice regarding Mr. Adler's account, you know, how successful would that be?
That was my thought immediately, was that 140 yes. characters, you know, that seems like a sufficiently creative, fully complete joke to me, mm-hmm. Perfectly fine creative expression worthy of copyright.
Yep, me too.
But
all right, any final parrot thoughts, Mike?
Nothing here.
No, thank goodness. I so need our animal selfie of the week this week. Let us move there now. All right, last week we had our first lemur. This week, we hereby present to you our first batch of meerkats attempting to create their own animal selfie. But I don't know technically if they succeed. We'll watch here for a moment and you guys can tell me what you think.
All right, everyone stand still. I got to go back. Nope.
I love these meerkats. They remind me so much of my little dog, who's more cat than dog anyway.
Oh, that's a good title, Virgil.
They're trying to make off with that GoPro and go scamper around with it like a little squirrel. But I think it's just too heavy for them. They're trying their darndest. They're very curious about it anyway. Oh, And there is their director attempting to get them to take the GoPro, I think.
Sorry, PETA, this case will not be a good one for you guys. Clearly no intent there.
That's right. The poor, mere lack of meerkat strength seems to be a factor here into whether they could actually make this an animal selfie or an animal film. But I hope that you have all enjoyed the meerkats as much as I did. We also have who put the turkeys in the discussion point. They're fairly
that was
awesome.
Me. That was yes. Since we're not going to have a show next week, I wanted to highlight the fact that some turkeys were protesting. A little example of civil disobedience in the post-Trump, pre-Thanksgiving world as turkeys held up traffic. Not quite an animal selfie. I couldn't figure out where else to put it in the show notes, but, you know, I would be remiss not to.
Yep.
All right.
holding up traffic in great protester fashion. Let us see what else we have for you. We have, speaking of protesters, several resources of the week, a couple of them specifically designed for protesters and activists. EFF has recently put out its digital security tips for protesters. So if you find yourself a protester in need of some digital security, that is a great place to start. Also, the Electronic Intifada has a guide to online security for activists. Both great places to protect yourself if you are an activist in any way. Anything you want to say about either of these, Emery?
Use Signal, use Tor. You know, basically that's not the only thing you need to do. Obviously, definitely check out these guides, especially if you are actually an activist organizing. You know, it might be important and certainly a useful skill to know. But yeah, use Signal, use Tor. You'll be good.
Right. And then we have another resource from Professor Melissa Zimdars from Merrimack College in Massachusetts. She has done her best to create a blacklist of sites to avoid, and I'm sure she will continue to update it. But known fake news sites, if you're interested, do follow, either look up Melissa Zimdars' list or you can look at the LA Times story in our discussion points for today to see, again, just another place to check and see if you're curious about whether the news story you're reading sounds too weird or good or otherwise outrageous to be true. If the source shows up on this list, maybe that's cause for concern. And then our tip of the week has to do with the music service Shazam. Shazam, like Jim Neighbors, right? If anybody remembers Gomer Pyle. Shazam is also the service. It was one of the first apps, right? Way back when the iPhone first came out that was sort of a dog and pony show of, hey, this is a fun thing my phone can do. It can listen to music and tell me what that song is because I can't quite place it. So Shazam is still around. But our tip is if you are a service like Shazam that needs to make recordings so that you can function, either turn the recording function off when it is not needed or make sure your users know what you're doing. The corollary tip is if you are a big fan of Shazam, you might want to be aware that its recording you its recording function stays on even when the microphone is toggled off in their app. So something that they just seem to have dropped the ball on there and hopefully will fix. But we wanted to let you know about it. Any thoughts on this, Mike?
Nothing on this end.
And Emery?
I got nothing. Sorry.
You know, shades of Amazon Echo here. How be aware what's recording you. It might not even be a device. It might be an app that purports to just record a little bit, but maybe it's staying on longer than that. So with that, I think we have made our way through the show today. We're so glad that you could join us here on This Week in Law. We get together every Friday, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC, now that we have undergone our fall time change here, at least in my neck of the woods. So join us live if you can. We love to have you play along with us. while we do the show, jump into our IRC at irc.twit.tv. But if you can't do that, don't worry about it. The show's going to be there for you whenever you get around to wanting to partake. And that would be at twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there. So join us when you can, how you can. Instructions on the various devices, be they the big screen TV on your wall or the little phone in your hand that you want to listen to or watch the show. We have all kinds of ways to make that easy for you. We'd also love to make it easy for you to get in touch with us and interact with us between the shows. You can find us all on Twitter. Our Twitter handles have been under our little talking heads throughout the show here. So find us there if you'd like. Great way to get in touch and let us know what you've spotted and hopefully vetted and fact-checked before you send along to us via RT. Love to hear from you there. Love to hear from you by email. We are respectively Denise and Emery and Mike at twit.tv. So email us at those addresses. Let us know what's on your mind in that format, or you can find us on Facebook or on Google Plus. The show has pages there. You can catch up between the shows on what we're brainstorming to talk about on the next show, and you can contribute and give us ideas what you think we should talk about and who you think we should invite on. We love hearing from you on those fronts. In fact, it makes it vastly more entertaining and rewarding for us when you go ahead and chime in and let us know what's on your minds about the issues that we discuss, the cyber and everything else that comes up on our show. So Mike, great to see you again. Great to have you back on the show.
With both of you as always.
Happy Turkey Day next week.
Thank you. You too.
And Emery, you as well. Any questions? Can we help you understand maybe better the period that is, the epoch that is about to unfold, or you think you're good?
Wow, that's a good question.
We're always
any
here.
Questions about anything in the future that you can help me with? Yes, absolutely. I will write them down and email them to you, though. If anyone else has any questions for me, please reach out on Twitter or contact me at on email, emery@twit.tv or at Emery Roan on Twitter. I really do love talking to you guys outside of chat, and it's great when you guys recommend articles for us. This has been... I think this might be my last show of the year. I'm doing a lot of traveling in December. I might be able to make it on the second, but if not, this marks the first year that I've been on the show, and it's been an absolute pleasure every single time.
Yay!
So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us for the first year you've been on the show. It's just been such a pleasure to work with you. Yeah. And I'm realizing the other reason I feel like we're going right back to the 80s is we're now is because Jerry Brown is governor here in California. That's lending some familiarity to this whole situation because he was governor from, 75 to 83, and he's been governor now from 2011 to present. But it really, now that we've had this shift in Washington, the California contrast to things, it seems all the more stark and, again, very familiar to how it felt back in the early 80s. So we will be here next week. We hope that you will join us too. And thank you so much for joining us today on This Week in Law.